my home department is the department of Iran, and then I'm housed at the Peace Science Center. And the Peace Science Center houses people from different departments that we all work on the teams at the same time together. Which is a really good model for enhancing collaboration. So, why is our field so important today? Why we're again at the forefront of everything that is in there? And the important things in life is because there's a perfect storm brewing, and if we don't resolve some of these things, we're going to be in a lot of trouble. We need to increase food production by 70% by 2050, is the prediction that is out there. The agriculture research and development spending has decreased in the last 20 years. And with climate change, the world is going to be hotter, drier, wetter, and some of my colleagues in meteorology actually says that it's not so much how hot or how cold it's going to be for how long, but that these events are going to be more violent, including storms. So the other problems that feed this storm is that we have poor seed development and seed quality under this condition. So the biology of the plant is going to be challenged to produce good, high-quality seeds when the environment around it is completely changed. And that's why we need so much seed conservation, because we need plant germplasm that will bring all those genes that will give this plant adaptation. We have been breeding for so long for the environment that we have today, that when this environment changes and becomes so violent, we're going to need a lot of new genes to include into this plant to still be able to remain at a high quality. So these are some of the complex things that are pressing plants into the seed production environment. So what is a seed? And I was lucky that none of my collaborators or in this symposium actually mentioned this, because I thought, you know, I'm going to be the last one to talk, so they would have said that a seed is whatever we have for getting the next generation of plants. And it's also the vehicle, and yes, now I remember there was a little pill in Hira's presentation that had the little embryo with passage of the heritable variation from one generation to the next generation of plants. So for this presentation, I'm going to use the more narrow definition of seed quality, which is that it's the physiological and genetic characteristics of the seed that will allow a uniform emergence under a varied environment for germination. And that seed quality aids in the storability of seeds if you store them under ideal conditions. So this basically means that if you have a healthy seed that's physiologically set and you store it, it will store for long periods of time and more degraded or more deteriorated. And seed quality depends on the composition of that seed, the genetic background of that seed, but it's very strongly influenced by the environment where the plant actually grew. So, again, as we said before, seeds are biological entities. So, seed quality is affected by the climatic conditions around them, and drought, extreme temperature, abiotic stresses, and other abiotic stresses will be critical, and especially during the reproductive cycle of the plant. So before we ever get to the reproductive stages of the plant, the number of seeds that we're going to get in a certain year is determined very early during vegetative growth. But once the seed is compromised, make a certain number of seeds. Then after fertilization, it will be the environmental conditions during that seed development and maturation that will determine how many of those seeds can be filled into normal, healthy, high quality seeds. So this is a very famous graph that we all use in our seed physiology classes, and we always go through this thing over and over. So at the time of fertilization, that would be the initiation of seed development. And then primarily the seeds will increase in fresh weight, basically because it increases in water and sugars inside that forming seed. And then at some point, those sugars start being deposited into dry weight, and that this is again an ortholog seed, not a recalcitrant. You know, being in the Midwest, I don't work a lot with recalcitrant seeds, although I could. So you get accumulation of dry matter based on all those sugars that were in the plant, and then you get to a point that in many different species depends how much water the seed has at that point, which is the time that the connection between the plant and the seed is severed, and after that, the seed just loses moisture. That can be 30% or 35% in corn, and it's usually 50% in soybeans, depending on what crop you're working. And after that, then the seed only loses moisture, and during all this time, the seed is completely dependent on the environment. Anything that happens before you get to physiological maturity will determine how many seeds are filled, how much the endosperm has of dry matter, how much starch or how much protein or how much other compounds are going to be deposited in those cells. And if you have an early frost, when this has so much water, also you will get a lot of deterioration on that seed like before you were before. So seed physiologists always say that your maximum possible seed quality is usually around physiological maturity. After that, if the seed has to fend for itself in the field, then it will be environmental conditions that will continuously deteriorate, and the biotic and abiotic stresses that might reduce that seed quality. So at the time that you get a seed for storage, it has undergone all this life, and whatever that life was is what you get as the seed quality that you're going to be storing. So never you can, my major professor used to say, you can never improve the quality of the seed in storage unless what it's doing is losing dormancy. All you do is try to keep it at that level. And know that however long you store that seed is going to first be at a very even level for germination, but then you're going to get to a point that it will really collapse in germination, like Christina was saying. And there's nothing you can do to stop it. You can slow it down, but you can't stop it. So seed survival and storage, the biological aspects of seed deterioration and initial seed quality, such as seed composition, the climatic conditions during the time that the plant was developed, and the genetic background, we cannot control. All we can control is the, wrong button. So all we can do is just control the timing at which we harvest those seeds and how we treat those seeds while we're trying to dry them and reduce the moisture to the moisture that needs to be safe for storage, and then how we handle the seed through that conditioning time to minimize mechanical damage. Those are all the things that we can do, but we can't control what happens while the seed is forming. And we know that those are going to be changing dramatically in the next 30 years. So the temperature and relative humidity in the storage environment, Christina talked a lot about that, so I'm not going to go through that, and the relative humidity of the storage environment is the most important factor when we're storing seeds. So we have some experiments where we actually had the seeds at 25 degrees Celsius, but the moisture content in the container where we were having them were 40%, and those seeds were almost as good as the ones that we had in the cold room, just because they were a lot drier. And so these are some of the tests that we can do or use to evaluate the seed quality as I define it, except for seed health testing that will be biotic traces that I'm not going to be covering. I'm just going to talk about the idea. So the difference between a biotic stress and an abiotic stress is that one are environmental and the other one are actually living entities, either other plant diseases or insects or animals that will attack the seed. I'm going to be talking more about non-biological stresses in terms of, I have no biological stresses and I have seed aging. That was, I don't know how we got there. But anyway, temperature, hail, salt, drought, and environmental conditions. Of course, seed aging is a fact that is biological. So some of the things we know, if the environmental change in the area where we are is drought, what we can expect is that the water stress will reduce photosynthesis and it will reduce transportation of photosynthesis to the seed. And that is going to reduce seed weight, and it's going to reduce seed yield. It will increase the number of shriveled seeds, and it will also increase the number of hard seeds that are present in the seed crop. We know that shriveled seeds that do not have good deposition of protein and starch into the seed at the time of development will actually have lower germination because they have fewer starch protein, and they will have they will not have ground seed. And then soybeans also will change the composition, and it will also have reducing seed quality by the changes in seed composition. Some other research in corn shows that when the water is late in the vegetative growth, time of floral infection, you can actually get asynchronous flowering, and with asynchronous flowering, then you get a lot more contamination with other genetic material. And you also can have senescence, meaning early death of the plant, and you can have reduced seed yield and for a number of spikes per plant, seeds per spike, and seed weight. In sorghum, we did not have, it was not a drought-induced stress, it was more a defoliation stress. Defoliation stress reduced photosynthesis, and so we had an increased number of seeds that have empty endosperms or not completely filled. Unfortunately, I put a little seed here, little picture. If this was bigger, you could see that there's no starch in those endosperm cells. They're empty, and there's just a few starch cells in there. And what that does to seed quality is that seed, for one, doesn't have enough reserves for germination or germinate very poorly or weakly. If this is a seed of corn, it also makes the endosperm spongy. So through conditioning, this will have a lot more deterioration. And then it will have hollow areas in the endosperm that will not transfer fluid properly. Water stress, dry conditions during harvest, you get an increase in hard seediness, but you also can have more of this effect. This is called inhibitional injury. Called inhibitional injury is very well documented. It happens in corn when it's too dry and it bites cold water very fast. But we actually reported that you can actually see individual injury if the seeds are too dry in a normal temperature of inhibition of 25 degrees Celsius. It's more a mechanical problem, but seeds will imbibe both from one surface and not from the other side of the seed if you're not giving them moisture uniformly, and then they will have actual physical torsion problems that because one colony on top and down another one, we crack the colony. So if we have this problem more frequently, we will have a lot more problems. Also, when you're trying to combine or harvest this kind of seed during this time, you will have a lot more mechanical damage if you are too dry and too brittle to harvest. High temperatures during seed development actually have been reported to produce changes in seed quality, serious changes in seed quality, just by a few degrees in temperature, especially night temperatures. You get accelerate of the rate of growth on the plant, and then when the temperatures increase or go in range, then the seed growth rate remains constant, but you get germination and vigor problems in seeds that are developing during very hot nights. So even though temperature will accelerate growth and plants will grow faster, then you will have lower quality seed on the seeds because of the night temperatures being high. Seed vigor, higher temperatures again can create germination and vigor problems, and the night temperature is the most serious problem for seed. So rice, seed quality and durability responses to day and night temperature are genetically predetermined, and the detrimental effects of high day temperature and night temperatures are more pronounced in cultivars that are normally grown in cooler climates. So if we don't have adaptation, if we don't have genes that we can bring into from the wild species, then we will lose area for production of rice. If those areas usually produce cooler types of rice, like sativa, cultivar, japonica. In corn, lower temperatures can create a problem. If we have more frequent events of low temperature during seed development and maturation, and those very low temperatures happen before the seed has reached physiological maturity, we're going to have a lot more reduction in seed vigor and germination, based primarily on the fact that cells with a lot of water will suffer two types of freezing injury. The number one is water freezes around the cells, and then it cools water from the cell faster. And that fast dehydration actually can not allow the proper defecation of that cell, and the cell will die. But also it creates ice crystals inside the cells, and those ice crystals also can deteriorate. And we have data that shows that the maternal plants has a lot to do with how that deterioration happens. Also, what seed composition the seed has. Usually, if seeds have very high protein content, then the frost effect is going to be a lot more damaging than with high oil seeds, for example. Fertilization, we were talking a little bit earlier about over-fertilizing plants. We were working with one of our soil collaborators, and he has had for many, many years plots where he had no phosphorus or potassium, and then increased one of the two to a level that is excessive for the crop. So when, for example, potassium was being increased, then all the other nutrients were kept to a normal level. And vice versa, when potassium was being increased, also the same happened. All the phosphorus and nitrogen and all the others were at ideal conditions. And when we were looking at the effect of only one nutrient, what we found is that excessive phosphorus and potassium actually did not improve seed quality. On the contrary, it actually decreased seed quality. And that the poor storage environment actually did not, uh, this higher concentrations of phosphorus and potassium in the plant did not really improve the storage time, and that excessive
what crop was that?
This, oh, I'm sorry. It was soybean.
Soybean, right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't put that. So, we also work with some colleagues of ours that were working on increasing oil content and protein content in corn. And what we found is that seed composition really plays an important role in seed quality. High protein corn with usually higher quality than high oil corn. The genotype or environment where the seeds were produced had a very big influence on seed quality. We were working between organic and conventional systems, and what she was trying to do, this was a colleague of mine who was a plant breeder, and she was moving her entire nursery back to organic type of agriculture, and she had been breeding for conventional corn. And what we found is that we had changes in protein content from, protein content was stable, but we had oil content differences when we moved it to an organic. Instead of decreasing oil content, actually, the lines that she was selecting for oil content actually had significantly higher oil content in an organic system. Unfortunately, she retired, so we didn't follow up on what type of oil profiles were changing. And to show you a little bit about the complexity of your job at conservation and how do you determine the best possible quality, one of the things that we were talking with Christina when we were planning this, she said, okay, if you're a person in conservation and you have to regenerate a certain attention, and what would you do? Would you try to regenerate it in the original environment that plant normally grows? Would you try to put a lot of fertilizer to increase the number of seeds that you produce and maybe decrease the number of times that you have to regenerate it? What kind of environment would you grow that attention on? And it really gets more complicated in the case of seed quality and as a trait. I work with a collaborator of mine on looking at genome fluidity. Genome fluidity is believed to be one of the changes that happens when you have a lot of cross-pollinated plants. They have the ability to recombine the genetic material a lot more often, but when you work with self-pollinated plants, they have to have a means of adaptation. They just cannot move from one environment to the next, and that it takes many, many years for a plant to actually change, or can they change faster if the environment gets really aggressive on them. So genome fluidity is defined as the capacity of that genome to reorganize, especially in self-pollinated species, and these changes are usually triggered by some kind of environmental stimuli. That could be an environmental stress, or that can be something that triggers too much nutrition, like in the case of our soybeans and potassium and phosphorus. And many of these genome changes can actually be called, or they have been called, allele switches or de novo variation. Can be very stable and actually heritable for several years after that change happens. So genetic changes were stably inherited in a large number of generations under control environments for flax. We collaborated. We collaborated with Susan Lolly on this particular project. Susan Lolly published a very, very controversial paper in Nature, where she says that actually she believes that there is a pool of RNA that can actually be reabsorbed into the plant when the plant is in an environment that is very stable, very harsh on the plant. After that change happens, then they can be actually inherited in a normal inheritance, Mendelian inheritance. So she calls it ancestral pool of information. This theory has not been published. I only know two people that have been working in this theory and that have published papers. One is Susan, the other one is Karina Bart, and they both are convinced that actually there is some kind of pool of ancestral DNA in plants that they can actually tap back and get it back into circulation. You know, there's a lot that we don't know about the junk DNA, that we call it junk DNA because we already know what it does. We looked, this particular work looked at transposable elements, and they were sure that they were not transposable elements because transposable elements usually leave a footprint when they change. So we really don't know what the mechanisms are. There's a lot of work now on epigenetics and other genetic changes that can be done with this. We were working on the beginning of this project. Unfortunately, it would be a project that will take many, many years to actually tell, maybe 14 years, like Hiro was saying, and my collaborator passed away. We're not going to be able to continue it. I just bring some of the things that we found to you so that you are aware of this, that the plant, the environment where the plants grow is so important that it can actually change the genetic inheritance of that particular plant for future generations. So in soybeans, Lark was the one that found that somatic changes can be identified in tissue culture of two lines of soybeans. Intra-cultivar variation of protein and oil within three adapted cultivars using a honeycomb design that's worked by Fasula. I think it's Vasilia Fasula's father, the one that decided to start selecting plants of tomato by spacing them very, very widely into a field and then selecting by single plant. And this was used by Burma in Fasula, and they actually found, they released several new varieties based on protein, and then they did the SSRs on those particular varieties because there was a big discussion if they were selecting for remaining heterozygosity in the line, or if they were selecting actually for new generated changes. And they could identify some of those as being components that were new bands that had not been there in that in this genetic cycle. So we were following the aconitase locus. We followed the aconitase locus because my collaborator had a lot of work, and it had a very simple gel way of determining what allele we were working with. And we were trying to see if those changes in the performance. Aconitase is an enzyme in the Krebs cycle, so if we could follow those allele switches in the frequencies of that particular enzyme, can we find seed composition changes, or was it being affected by this particular switch? So we're working with two varieties, VSR101 and JAG. VSR101 has purple flowers and is known to have a lot of this genetic variation. JAG is a white flower variety, and this is what a honeycomb design is. So we started calling it a stress, but then we actually started calling it a stimuli because actually with overabundance of sand and soil minerals for each plant. And then leave it all to science, we had a hailstorm, So this plant that were already stressed by this honeycomb, they also were stressed by scale. So then we were working with the descendants of this plant, because some of these plants actually made it to seed. And then we had to start separating this effect of honeycomb for one side, scale in the other side, and we decided, I came in by stressing the seed and aging it, and then see if that created variation. So we observed, there's several papers that probably will be coming out of this, but one of the things we observed was male semi-sterility in the plants. And so we had either pods showing constriction, meaning they're missing one seed, or showing abortion. This is what the aconitase, my collaborator was Rick Palmer, and he had a very easy isozyme method to determine what allele was actually in the plant at the time. And he worked with two aconitases, aconitase 4 and aconitase 2, two different genes. And what we found is that when the plants were stressed with very low levels, maybe transplant or cross-pollination, we had a low level of genome changes for the markers that we tested at least. And then we had severe stress plants, like honeycomb flat scale, then the frequency of these genome changes was a lot higher. And this is actually a field that shows some of that variation. This is a heritability test. We were in the second generation with this plant already. Yes. Okay, 5 minutes. We're almost there. So these are some of the phenotypic changes we observed. We observed changes in the pubescent color, maturity by a week or more, and some other plant characteristics. We also found insertions and deletions that were not there. We found single base pair changes in some of these plants. And maturity differences, and so most of these changes that we found when we created environmental stimuli were actually primitive traits. So it was reversion to shattering in many of these plants. Many had black seeds, small seeds, sharp pubescence, and these are some of the people in that particular team. Scott and Kathy. Kathy graduated with her PhD and is already working in industry for Pioneer. Susan Lawley, the person that thinks that this variation is actually a bank of primitive variation that the plant has somewhere to be able to cross. Lauren was an undergrad. She's also working in industry. Ruth got a master's degree. She's also working in industry with my collaborator, Reed, with Marianne Hopkins, a postdoc at Susan Lawley's lab. Scott, USDA, and my collaborator with the USDA scientist. Scott worked with USDA also, and he was a Reed technician until Reed retired. And then Grace is the last student. She's finishing her PhD now on the project. And some of the papers on this have got out. We found yellow lethal, and that one we collaborated with the Vinder in the University of Wisconsin at Stevens Point. And he did a lot of the molecular work. We found the spontaneous generation of allelic variation in response to sexual hybridization and other stress. We found yellow viable plants, so they were totally yellow and they actually grew to maturity. And that's my collaborator, Dr. Palmer. So what do I have to leave you with? I completely confused you by telling you all these different things that are going to happen and all these tragedies. What I really want you to remember is that that overabundance of nutrients and sunlight may create phenotypic changes and genetic changes that might change the seed composition and seed quality in this environment, but that not only this overabundance of nutrients, but also the fact that plants, seed composition and seed quality will vary with environmental stresses, and that the genetic changes that we originate with some of these stimuli can be stable and heritable, which will actually explain evolution. But that it doesn't need to have many generations to actually change the plant, that small changes are happening every time and every generation. And yes, we do have mutations, those happen at a very low rate, but what this type of stimuli did is increase that variation by 10%. So instead of having 1% of normal mutations, we were having 10% of mutations that we could follow, that we could differentiate, and that we can actually get heritable for next generation. Now, we did only two generations. There is information in the literature that actually some of these genetic changes that happen only remain in the genome for about 5 generations. We didn't get that far, so we're not quite sure. Some of the changes we observe black seeds, we observe all kinds of different things that I did not report. Those were epigenetic changes. They were not heritable. The next generation lost them. But these are from some of those that are heritable. Okay, so.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Well, Dana?